Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello, this is The Reasonable Voice, where we connect the dots. The mission of The Reasonable Voice and The Reasonable Voices working together on our Blog Talk Radio shows is connecting the dots between politics and finance, a need for greater education, humanity and world peace, and, of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide to our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination for equality and equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world, embracing creativity and political unity as solutions to all our problems. Today, my guest is one I just met not terribly long ago, but a very impressive fellow. George, is it George Nick or George Conrad?
No, it's George Nick.
George Nick. Okay. George Nick, I asked, well, never mind. George Nick is an artist, painter, educated at Yale University, All Students League. He studied with Edwin Dickinson of the North Brooklyn Museum of Art School. As a teacher, he has educated artists at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and the Massachusetts College of Art in Boston. He's been all around. He's had 51-man shows in New York City, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, many other cities. Well, first of all, George, welcome to the show, and thank you for being on today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure, I assure you. I understand, I know I get a lot of communications from an iPad, so you are quite up with, how do you marry the painting traditional painting and the modern technology and all of that? You seem to be comfortable with both?
Well, it must be some sort of illusion that you're in, because I don't feel comfortable with both.
Oh, really?
How did you get to that idea that I was?
Because I get so many communications from you from your iPad, and I'm one who is iPad challenged. So I was so impressed.
My daughter got that for me last year when we were in Venice, so we could talk to each other by Skype.
Uh-huh.
And I learned from that there are two things I can do. I've learned how to text, and I've learned how to send images of my paintings to my friends and discuss them.
Fantastic.
And get mail. So those three things are it.
Well, you're doing very well at all three, I have to say. Well, you are now the painter in residence at the University of Virginia, and I understand that Professor Bill Geiger there mentioned that you are a teacher's teacher. What have you done that gave him that impression? Tell us.
Well, I don't know. I'm a compulsive teacher. I'll stop anybody on the street and start talking to them and helping them out in some way. It's in my genes, I guess. When I came here, the first thing I did was I went to visit them, and I started talking to he and his wife about their paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows an awful lot, and I have wonderful conversations with him, and it's like, you know, professionals talking together.
Sure.
You can't have that kind of a conversation with anybody else, and you miss it unless they're really qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil is really qualified. And one of the few people, excuse me, I can talk to for any kind of length, which I love to.
Sure. That sounds great. So if he's so qualified, obviously he's right about your being a teacher's teacher. You recently had a one-man show at the University of Virginia. Yes, that's where I met you. How was that received? And tell us something about your work.
Well, how flowers received. I mean, I got lauded there. You know, people come up and said something, and I took the students in there to talk to them about the paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was a favorable response. They were very interested, and they had a lot of questions. I say, of course, because they're not strangers. They're in my class.
Yeah.
So they have to excited, I guess.
Well, I was excited, and I'm not in your class. Truth be told, of course, full disclosure, my wife is an associate professor in studio art at the University of Virginia, and she had invited me to come see your show, but she said, you're going to really love this. It's really fascinating and different, and I did, absolutely correctly. Could we perhaps try and make those listening today see, I know we can give a website and they can actually go look at your work, but could you describe any one of your works to us? And, you know, and I'm thinking about the angles that struck me and of what angles that might be considered not what you usually expect to see on canvas. How about that?
Well, I don't usually describe my paintings. I mean, the paintings, I looked at it.
Yes.
Wait a minute, I gotta, Scott, sorry.
Sorry, George, it's all right.
I'm sorry. I try to ask people when they tell me something about a painting of mine,
mm-hmm.
to describe it to me. I mean, I've done thousands of paintings. And they cannot describe the painting. I mean, if it's a house on the street, that's what I want to know. And they might be talking about colors,
mm-hmm.
or something else, or their impression of it, and it doesn't describe the painting to me.
Yes.
I think the different arts and different mediums do not mix.
Uh-huh.
I'm an old fashioned thinker on that realm.
Uh-huh.
When I was young, I wanted to do visual operas.
Ah.
Figure paintings and stories and all that. And as I learned more and more about the art, I found out that I didn't really have a story to tell. I saw things that I liked and I wanted to paint the world. I'm a realist.
Yes.
And I work from observation. That's a closer, best description, I think, even though it might not be correct. That gives somebody an idea that when they're looking at a fire engine, they're not going to see Elizabeth Taylor or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah.
Pretty much the subject. I stick pretty closely with it, and I work with light. And when you're talking about angles and things like that, I don't plan these kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
The reason I was painting angles is that I was painting on Newbury Street in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and I moved to Boston to paint those stores and the architecture, and I've been doing that now since 1969. So what I get involved with something, I try to understand what it is I'm looking at, and mm-hmm. I'm actually reconstructing a parallel world of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't that it's an imitation of the world, it's actually a reconstruction. I don't know if that phrase makes it clearer, but I have to begin from scratch to re-understand the form and space and use the colors to make what I'm looking at.
I think that's an excellent way of putting it, a reconstruction. And I just thought the buildings themselves, and again the colors, the numbers of the address, it just seemed to give, and I'm not trying to be flippant here, but a twist to reality that just so fascinated me. That's why I wanted to meet you, and did, and then ask you to be on the show.
Well, the twist is a good phrase, I think. I never heard that one before. But I think that's what I do. I ingest what I'm looking at, and I'm going through the medium I have, an oil medium.
Mm-hmm.
Mixing, all you can do is mix colors and tones and make edges and shapes and things like that. And you're trying to reconstruct something that's very difficult and very elusive.
Mm-hmm.
So all the knowledge that you have to do that isn't really going to get you to make that object. You're going to make it's another world, the parallel world.
Yes.
Of reconstructing it so it has the idea of form and space, but you know, form and space is not seen. contrary to popular opinion.
Uh-huh.
I think if you don't move and you look at something, the whole world's flat.
Mm.
The reason that we know of form and space is that when we're young and we feel objects and walk around them, we're trained to understand what a floor, what a person, what a cushion, what an animal is. And everybody has to say, we're all trained with the same knowledge to survive in this world and get around.
Mm-hmm.
So all I'm doing is taking the knowledge plus the seeing and reconstructing that combination. And I think it does get to be, you didn't say warped. What did you say?
I said twist, a new twist.
Twisted, right.
Yes.
It does get twisted because you get in between it.
Yes. Yes. That's fascinating. That's exactly the way I felt. I felt surrounded by. It was like, as you say, a parallel world, but it looked. It was functioning in a different way because it was. It looked twisted. Not twisted in the sense, in the slang sense that people mean, as in something wrong with it, but that it was altered. It was my perception of it was
right,
altered.
Right.
Yes.
What you're leading up to is the next part of this.
Yeah.
Is that is completely accurate, what you were seeing. What you were seeing is everybody doesn't get that as an idea. They have their own idea. It's like looking at a foreshortened and figured from the feet to the nose. You don't understand that is a figure. You want a figure standing up. You understand?
Uh-huh.
You understand what I just said?
Yes. Yes.
Well, what I'm saying is that if you measure accurately, and you're going to put this on a flat surface, if
yes.
you measure angles accurately, and you put it all together with that skill, people are going to say to you, well, I don't see it that way. It looks like you're distorting it. Why are you distorting it? And then I can set about proving to them, if they sit there with me, that is exactly what they see, only they don't realize it.
Hmm.
They have another image, like a photographic image from a distance, about what that building should really look like.
Then
am I getting up close to it and seeing these all kinds of distortions and angles, which they really see, but it doesn't register in their brain.
Because they've been preconditioned by what is their sense of reality for so long?
I don't know the precondition. They don't think about it, but they have a general understanding that a car looks like a car. If you get underneath it or at a sharp angle, they're going to say, that's not really a picture of a car. A picture of a car is I can see the whole car, you know, like that.
I see. Uh-huh.
See, then they call it distortion.
Oh.
And then they believe they don't see it. But they actually are seeing it,
yes.
and it doesn't register that way.
Gotcha. Well, I was fascinated, and I imagine your students are as well. I mean, you've been teaching for 54 years. There must have been
I don't know. I think they would be bored from this conversation. Talk about other things. I can talk to my students about stuff like this, but people generally don't need to know that or want to know those kinds of things.
Oh.
They just want to know if it isn't distorted, why isn't it distorted or something like that.
Well, I hope we get a little deeper than that. And I was so impressed. And when I go to UVA to the art exhibits, I like to stand in the center of the room. I'll come back to that. But I have a history of many, many, many decades ago. I worked at the Federal Trade Commission, which is right across the street from the National Art Gallery. And for lunch, to get as far away from the mindset that I needed to have, I did payroll for a summer there. And to get away sort of from that mindset, during lunch I'd walk across the street to the National Art Gallery, which was a marvelous place to go play. And I would sit, I made it my choice to sit in one gallery for my entire lunch hour. And from that position, I might turn on my seat, but I would stay in that position and look at the art, and then the next day I would get closer to it, and the next day it was another gallery and so forth. And I discovered what I think you were saying a moment ago, is that if you just take the time to let go of the preconceived notions and look long enough, you start seeing with more than your eyes, and then you see more, if that makes sense. So
it does make sense. I think I love music a great deal, and I find out that I had trained myself to learn pieces, not because I like them, but I thought I could learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out after a while that I was capable of ingesting different forms that originally I wasn't interested in at all, or different pieces I wasn't interested in at all. Study does really strange things. It opens up your brain and opens up your heart and opens up everything to respond. Then you find out after a while if you really like it or if you really don't. But if you don't understand it, you don't have a foothold on really doing what the brain wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there's too many cliches that keep us from really going. I think that was a great thing for you to sit in the middle of that gallery and try to look.
Yes.
No.
And it was, and of course the National Art Gallery has plenty to offer, so it was in many ways one of the best summers of my life. Certainly it was the best lunch hours spent in my life.
Terrific.
And I just I mean, I've always loved art. I'm not a painter. I am a former opera singer, studied at Peabody, etc., and had a bit of a career with the Baltimore Opera way back when, before my New York years. But I'm not surprised, the more I talk to you and the more I read about you, that paths crossed and that we ended up with sharing a sense of humor, if nothing else. But back to your work and your exhibit. First of all, how long will you be at UVA in residency there?
Well, I'm here for the semester.
Oh.
I'm teaching a class, so the contract was for, I think it's the end of April, beginning of May.
So we can still, not that your works aren't in many places, but where can we come, those close enough to University of Virginia, can we come and see, I know your particular exhibit has closed, but is the work still available to be seen?
Oh, no, it was shipped to Cape Cod Museum in Dennis, Massachusetts, out on the Cape, and that same show is being given there. In fact, I'm playing hooky on 1 week in April to be there for an opening and give a talk for the show there.
Excellent. You know, that's something I don't know that most people who are not involved in art in one way or another. I mean, it's kind of, I guess, if you're in theater and you go on the road, you take a show on a tour, it's something like that. You have some way of understanding it. But for the artist, there you are in a show, and if you are of a stature such as yours, a one-person show, and then there's all the packing of and putting it all together in the crates and everything that happens, not that you do that personally, but and then shipping it to a new place and the unloading and how to hang it and with the lights. I mean, there's so much involved, and then it's another show, and I don't think that's like a tremendous new concept to share, but I don't think most people understand how much time and expertise has to go in just to transferring an exhibit from one place to another, let alone from two different states.
Well, there is a lot of work involved. I'm not involved with any of that.
Yes.
That's all arranged and it's all taken care of. But it's not like being on the road. That's a different thing. You see, when you're on the road as an actor or a performer,
uh-huh.
you are actually on the line creating your work at that time.
Yes.
I'm away someplace else making the work.
Uh-huh.
The work is simply being exhibited. There's no correlation between that it's not the same. It's not that I'm going out and making a painting in front of an audience.
Good point.
So it's very, very different. And it's very passive in that way. The real creation comes out in private someplace else months ago or even years ago.
Wow.
The work is left as evidence.
Beautifully put. So beautifully. I'm going to take a break there, George. This is fantastic. We're not going away. We're going to just take a brief break. We'll be right back with painter, artist George Nick, who currently is the painter in residence at the University of Virginia. I had the great pleasure of meeting him a few weeks ago during his one-man art exhibit at UVA. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I want to say my heart, play my part, make my mark. I want to leave my mark forever, put art together with guilds, weld, melt, and build architecture, carve curves like carpenters and carpe diem, construct structures in stucco, craft columns and coliseums, Les Miserables and mezzanines, mosaics and museums. I want to create craft stones and statues, pristine castles like the Sistine Chapel, the ceiling touched with my acrylic brush inside the basilica. I want to make a masterpiece, weave a tapestry in a monastery with a Catholic priest for all those to see who's coming after me. I want to inspire churches and chapels with tin spires and steeples, Gothic cathedrals, painting the saints on easels and empires. I want to paint a palace with my palette. I want to bring goodness like culinary artists bring food to your palate with bottles of wine. I want to model design, polish, refine with my talent. I want to say my heart, play my part, make my mark.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest is George Nick, artist and painter in residence at the University of Virginia, whose work has been, he's had 50 one-man shows and all over, especially the United States, but also in foreign countries as well. New York City, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, his work at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and Charlotte, North Carolina. I mean, I could go on and on. Johannesburg Museum of Art in Johannesburg, South Africa. Tel Aviv Museum. He's a very special guest and an extremely special artist, I feel. I've had the good fortune of seeing his work and meeting him, and he has a great sense of humor. So, George, during the break, you were telling me you're happy in the morning just because you're waking up. I know the feeling.
I don't know if that's a leading question. I don't know if I have a follow-up on that.
Well, I'm not down to counting the days yet, but I am certainly aware with this winter of shoveling snow that if it's not getting easier, at least I'm getting better at the challenges, perhaps. How about yourself?
Well, it's been very disappointing to me. You see, I had some sort of strange vision that I was going to the tropics when I came down here, and leaving all that awful winter. And I would call up, my wife just came down about a few weeks ago, and I would call her up and she would say, how is the weather there? I said, it's 8 degrees here. And she said, my goodness, it's warmer here. We've got 12.
Yes.
There's this kind of comparison going on, and I start projects, and they take a long time, and I started some projects out in a dairy farm up in Somerset, because they had some old steam tractors out there that really attracted me, and a whole bunch of them, and the farmer was so marvelous here that he encouraged me and even moved one from inside outside so I could do it in the sun and all that stuff.
Wow.
And I've been going there regularly, but I haven't been able to accomplish much work because I'm an on-site painter, and I started these outdoors. I mean, my fingers froze for a while when I was just doing the drawing, and one of them hasn't even started to paint on it. They have these two big projects, and I've only gotten one about halfway done, and time is running out. I'm getting very nervous here, but I hope this week, when the t- temperature gets into 40s and upward, I manage to work outside.
Oh, wow. Well, even that's something. To work outside in 40-degree weather, you're not wearing gloves, or you wear half gloves with your fingers?
Oh, don't worry. I wear long underwear and boots and all that stuff. But it isn't that. It's that the paint gets sticky beside me getting cold and doesn't move well.
Mm.
So when you get in the 40s, it's bearable. Listen, 40 is warm. We've had temperatures, you know, below zero for weeks up in Boston.
Wow.
So when it gets to 40 degrees, it is like the tropics, and I start these spring paintings at that point, making a mistake. Of course, I jumped the gun too much, I think, in those things.
Mm. But you say you're an on-site painter.
I work from observation. Everything I paint, I'm looking at constantly. I don't make up anything. I don't use photographs. I don't try to change anything. I try to be as honestly as possible,
mm-hmm.
and in that I'm trying to get that accurate color or the accurate tone, and that's where the change happens. Is that what was the word? I still don't remember the word you used before.
Twisted.
I love that word. Everything is twisted because we're unable to match things or use them because if we did that, we'd have a dead painting. So we have to make the colors work together at mm-hmm. the same time. And that involves a lot of extra kind of activity that makes the art pleasurable and people wanting to look at it.
Yes.
Nobody knows that part of it. That's a secret, so don't tell anyone.
That won't. Secret's safe with me.
Okay. But when you're making a painting, there is a thing of putting the colors together that have meaning,
mm-hmm.
and after a while, it I think your passion comes out in what you do with those things and how you manipulate them,
mm-hmm.
and how you want it to work and all that stuff. So that you can do things with the color, you can do things that are art.
Mm-hmm.
If it isn't felt, if it isn't started from, in my eyes, started from the reality. Starting from what's given, what nature gives you.
Yes.
That's what I want, but I twist it. It manages to be twisted because the color I'm putting down is awful, although it seems to be like a good color from what I'm looking at.
Yes.
So it's generally manipulated. That's the twisting comes into mm-hmm. it to make it more meaningful on that flat surface. Those compilation of colors together.
Yes. And you, this I know seems like such a elementary question, but you create this three-dimensional effect. You keep saying to avoid the flat or to enhance the flat surface, but your work certainly does that. I mean, I not only felt like I was surrounded and therefore on the street, but that I could feel the actual physical tension of climbing the hills because I felt askew, and yet I couldn't take my eyes off of it. So I suppose I imagine if that's the kind of reaction you're looking for, you certainly got it from me.
Well, it's not just a reaction, it's a training.
Ah.
That's what I train my students, is that they ask, you know, there's no books written on this. You have to use the pit of your stomach to understand space is working and form is working. I haven't turned the painting upside down to make sure that does happen. Because if they can't analyze what they're painting, they can't improve upon it or they can't make the effect they want.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to feel the space and the form in what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And now putting the right tones together and the right drawing doesn't guarantee that's going to happen.
Mm.
So there's these slight modulations that are very, very crucial to the reading and the whole painting. And that's the miracle that painters go through that we admire so much, that you don't think about that at all. It just looks like a nice head or a nice horse or a nice cloud or whatever. But it takes a lot of artistry to make that work.
And can you, like a classroom instructor, an artist in residence, can you tell us any inkling of how one goes about actually doing that? I mean,
well, if I was with you, I would punch you in the stomach or stomp on the floor and said, "Now, did you feel that? Do you understand what a cement floor feels like.
Yes.
Now, is that the effect that you're getting when you're painting that? There's no way that anybody can train you that if you're not looking for it, want it, or it's possible for you to even try to make it.
Yes. At least double upon it. Yes.
I mean, a lot of people use very clever tricks and do very clever things, but in the real judgment of it, anybody looking at it must be convinced, and you don't have to be an artist to be convinced. Anybody off the street will say, well, that shoe looks like it's in water or far away or something like that, and mm-hmm. they do see those things. But to translate it, you mm-hmm. must go revert back to your intuitions and all the skills you have to try to make it work.
Wow. George, where are you?
Is that too much for you?
Oh no! You see, no, I'm being what's a good word? I'm being washed over. I'm feeling not overwhelmed, but certainly challenged. Not overwhelmed, but I feel like there's a new source of waterfall or something. I don't know. I hope that makes sense.
Well, the thing is that students go through this, they live through this, and they suffer through this until it becomes habit.
Uh-huh.
Then they can start to go beyond the skills and the necessary activities to make things operate correctly. Then they can start instituting their feelings into it. And then they can start making it useful in that sense, make it real art.
Hmm. What are you, after your residency at University of Virginia is finished, where are you going then?
I'm just going home.
And that's Boston?
Yeah, it's outside of Boston, Concord.
Oh, all right. Well, very historical area. I presume you've done a lot of painting there.
Yeah,
on site.
I think the first 3 years I painted everything I could there, and now I'm not interested much anymore, and I'm looking around the rest of the world.
Very good. What? Where can we? I mean, I know one can go to a museum, and that's probably the best place to see your work. But is there a website? Places where we?
Well, I think if you look up my name, you can find something. But I think I'm not good at, that's where you said I was good at this. I can't set up my own site and I have nothing to do with it. So, and the last show I had was the gallery Naga, N-A-G-A, in Boston. If you look them up, you'll get what my most recent show was, things like that.
Okay. And it is George Nick, N-I-C-K. Yes. Okay. Well, I'm, you know, honestly, George, I couldn't... I leave all that technical stuff as well, including the putting this show together after we record it. That's all done by people who know people younger than I and or than we are, and you know, who put all that together. So to each his talent, and may we all excel. That's all I say.
Hear, hear.
How did you feel about? Any particular reactions to share with us or experiences in South Africa and Tel Aviv? Two very different places, but...
I mean, it's all the same for me. It's all something to look for in paint, you know.
Uh-huh.
I never went to South Africa. I went to Tel Aviv. I've been all over Europe.
Uh-huh.
But that I had a painting in that museum is not because I was there.
Ah, okay.
So, I mean, I like people and I like the world, so it's always a pleasure for me to be anywhere.
And when you see something or someone you want to paint, there you are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on call like a doctor. I mean, I'm always looking and wondering. While I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm in this room, and I'm thinking about, you know, maybe I can make something out of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always that potential which I might have missed.
Ah, uh-huh.
Afraid of missing something. Well, you know, when I was first learning this and I was trying to figure out a style or a technique or a manner, and I thought, I really like to, I think I really like to paint anything. Mm-hmm. Then I found after a while that was the wrong statement.
Mm.
The statement was I wanted to paint everything.
Ah.
I think everything's fair game, subject-wise.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I haven't just figured it out yet.
Huh. And what brought you together with the University of Virginia? How did that happen? Was that...
Well, it was Phil Geiger.
Uh-huh.
I met when I was at a similar situation in Roanoke at Hollins University.
Uh-huh.
I was at a table, a discussion panel, and he was there, and I met him. And I've looked at his work and admired his work for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And we've communicated here and there for a long time. And then he asked me if I would be interested. And I said, sure.
Yeah. Excellent. And the students are, I just find, I know because of my wife, I've met a lot of, I don't necessarily know them, but I've met a lot of art students at UVA. And they all seem... what's a good thing? They all seem what we like to think young people are. All young people, they're enthusiastic and optimistic.
That's a good one. I think that's what I felt also.
Oh, good.
They seem young, enthusiastic, and intelligent. I loved it.
Yes, and curious,
and game.
Yes.
And game.
Yes.
Anything I threw at them, so I like that.
What's the biggest challenge you're giving them?
The biggest challenge?
Yeah. The whole thing. The whole experience with you, yes.
The mix of color, that's the biggest challenge.
Yes.
See, that sounds like a joke.
No, but I understand. No, I know.
No way. You see, there are a lot of rules and regulations about how to mix color, and all of them have no basis in truth.
Mm.
Because there is no rule about mixing color. We get all these colors on the palette, and the thing is, I tell them to start with wrong colors. They have some sort of technique or some sort of idea to go after a certain kind of feeling a certain way. And I said, no, think only of temperatures, get the value, and make a stab at it. But then you have to end up with a color that you like.
Mm.
That's the mystery,
mm.
and that's the magical part of it. If you like a color, you're going to treat it differently than if you're working with a color you don't like.
Mm. Interesting. And then
they have to have their passions involved some way.
Yes.
In all of this. And they were stunned when I asked them. I remember I've had a master class the last couple of years in Concord, and I asked them how they felt about that color. Do you like it? And they sort of said, well, and then I yelled at them,
yes.
Do you love it?
Yeah.
And it sort of stunned them. They never believed that they had to love it.
Yes.
You know, really feel strongly about it.
Well, I can understand that. I hear what you're saying. It obviously it's going to pull something out of you that if you were lukewarm about it, just wouldn't happen. It wouldn't
right.
be the same artwork. Wouldn't be the same finish. Hmm.
Well, it wouldn't be the same thrill either.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, there's a response to their work that they get to every once in a while, and I said, forget the rules, forget anything that's going on, even forget about making it work. If you can get it to get that feel out of it, you're closer to it than anybody else.
Mm.
And one person asked me once, do you think Mozart liked his music? I said, he adored
yes.
his music.
He must have to have done.
What question is that?
Yes. Having composed so much and in so many different genres, I hope he had to have loved it. How could he not?
Yeah.
You know, gee, Beethoven and all. Oh, I've resisted asking you purposely because I think it's always a silly question, who's your favorite artist? And I'm not asking you now, but are you your favorite artist?
Oh, God, no. I think I'm at the bottom of the pile.
Oh.
I think making it, living through it's very different than from simply approaching it effortlessly.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you take two composers, you take Mozart and you take Beethoven, completely different in the way they worked,
yes.
the way they thought, the way they made things, but they were sort of on the same high level,
mm-hmm.
so it really doesn't make any much difference how you go about it,
mm-hmm.
or what you do, your techniques. It's the result only that counts.
Yes.
And try to make something worthwhile. I think you have to have something in you to recognize worthwhileness, don't you?
Got you. Yes. Yes.
If you see it other places, then when something makes you feel good, you're on the road to it.
Hmm.
So try to control that wild stallion and finish the piece and not kill it.
Yes.
Is another kind of thing. It was like Picasso, who worked on this, what was his portrait of Gertrude Stein, and he worked on it all winter or something like that.
Yes.
And then he took it home, and then all of a sudden, he didn't have her there anymore, and he remembered there was a Cezanne portrait back of her in her studio office where he was painting it.
Uh-huh.
And somehow that influenced the finish of the painting, like African sculpture did his work also. But the thing is that it did something, and he finished it in one day.
Wow.
That's the painting we have of Gertrude Stein, you know. There's no way to know how to go about something, but the reaction is our big guide.
Yes.
Our reaction.
Yes. And our beginning is our reaction. What we see and what we want to see and make out of it. It's been absolutely fascinating. I mean, my mind is just reeling with... it's just, you know, it's like you opened another door there or something, or two or three doors, maybe a tunnel to someplace, but...
good grief.
I know. But it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and so... what do I want to say to not be too corny sounding? So soulful. It's about when you're open to the art that's in you as well as about you. And you've just hit it like a ball in a pinball machine. It's been flying around, tapping on everything, waking it up, making it respond and have a reaction and act and then act accordingly. Anyway, I don't want to ramble. This has been fabulous. George Nick, who is currently the painter in residence at the University of Virginia, has worked in a number of artistic work hanging in a number of museums in this country and other countries, and we're just very fortunate to have him in this area and to have him on this planet, and those who are fortunate enough to see his work and study with him, well, they are lucky people indeed. Thank you so much, George, for being on the show.
Thank you, Rachel.
All right. Don't go away, everyone. We're going to say goodbye to George right now, but we'll be right back with the Reasonable Voices, Blog Talk Radio. Hope you've enjoyed the show as much as I have.
Make my mark. I want to leave my mark forever. Put art together with guilds, weld, melt, and build architecture. Carve curves like carpenters and carpe diem. Construct structures and suckle. Craft columns and coliseums. Les Miserables and mezzanines. Mosaics and museums. I want to create craft stones and statues. Pristine castles like the Sistine Chapel. The ceiling touched with my acrylic brush inside the basilica. I want to make a masterpiece, weave a tapestry in a monastery with a Catholic priest for all those to see who's coming after me. I want to inspire churches and chapels with tin spires and steeples, Gothic cathedrals, painting the saints on easels and empires. I want to paint a palace with my palette. I want to bring goodness like culinary artists bring food to your palate with bottles of wine. I want to model, design, polish, refine with my talent. I want to say my heart. Play my part. Make my mark.
The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Danielle Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for coming back and sticking with us and sharing our thoughts and feelings and programs with your friends, both online and off. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, and what about... sustainability, artistic sustainability. How many artists out there? You know, I'll start this off with a quick story. So what else is new? Everybody. Two quick stories, but they're part of the same thing. All my life, I was lucky, I guess, in the sense that in the sixth grade, I knew what I wanted to be. And that didn't change until I was long after the sixth grade. But I started out wanting to be a director and an actor and a singer in that order. And that's, you know, and school teachers were very supportive and whatever until, I guess, high school, and then it was time to do this thing. And then everybody for years said, say it with me, everyone, when are you going to get a real job? And we've all heard that, and I heard it for decades, and until, literally, I was on national television, my parents and others did not stop saying, when are you going to get a real job? So, and they were very supportive, but, you know, you go on TV, hey, okay. Now, the second story, I can't remember now, but that's probably good enough to open the discussion. If I sound a little wired this morning on the show, I haven't eaten today, and I'm drinking a lot of black coffee, but I'm happy and I'm upbeat, especially for the people here, and we're talking about the arts. So sustainability is a big subject in Charlottesville, in Virginia, in America. And, oh, I know what the other story was. Way back when the Grand food store, was it a food store? The Grand, they don't know, they're all young here. The Grand food store, I think it was a food store, grocery store, closed, and all those people lost their jobs. My best friend and I from college, he's a conductor, and he too has been fortunate enough, as I have been, to always pursue our career successfully. He said, you know, all those people who kept telling us we should get real jobs, and now the sad thing, and we weren't mocking in any way, but the sad truth was we knew people. That's what it was, Grand, because I happened to be dating the general manager of the Grand grocery store, and that's how I knew the inside story. But here these people who had done what everyone said, gone out and got the 9-to-5, worked their tails off just so they might have a piece of their dream on the weekend or a cocktail party on Friday night, and now that was no longer secure, and that was way back before my New York years, and here we are now in economic times that we have to go, maybe the 9-to-5 is just not what it used to be, and maybe we're being forced to pursue our dreams.
Well, as I was leaving the house today, I saw this commercial that I've seen a few times now where New York is offering tax-free for 10 years people who want to move there and start a business.
Oh, my God. New York City or New York?
New York City.
Holy smokes.
And there's certain zones that they have designated where you don't have to pay taxes. And I was like, that's incredible. 10 years of tax-free. They said if you have something innovative, something that's going to make, you know, jobs, we want it here.
Yeah.
And that's what you're saying. As I was watching the commercial, like, people are now getting it. Like,
yeah.
The old way is over.
It's over.
There's no more of...
Get a real job.
The real jobs are you have to create a job.
Exactly.
Because the only things left is creativity, because the Industrial Revolution mindset is over now.
So how do you, and I don't think we should be frightened by that. I think that's a kind of welcome thing, although I know people going through hard times, and heck, I'm selling off real estate like crazy. So I do understand that, but at the same time, it kind of nudges us into being entrepreneurs, or at the very least pursuing our dreams instead of, you know, have something to fall back on. How many times have we heard that? Michelle.
Yeah, well, I think I think about this topic as it relates to Charlottesville, and there's a lot of local artists around here, and I think there's a lot of entrepreneur hype. You know, there's a lot of startups and young minds wanting to have different companies, and I think that the question can sometimes be, you know, what is going to allow somebody who has a lot of creativity, what's going to afford them the means to do what they hope to do? You know, so thinking about like New York and the tax-free, you know, that's a start. You know, where, but I think that sometimes, because maybe the mindset for so many years is like, you know, when are you going to get a real job? Mm-hmm. There can be less of a willingness, I think, to fund, you know, and especially if it gets to the arts. I mean, we're talking just like literary arts, creative, you know, like visual art, poetry, all of that. I mean, a lot of times there's just this sense of that's extra.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But that's the very thing that is the core of creativity, which mm-hmm. creates the new jobs, which then fuels the market. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I think Bernard could tell us a little bit about the bridge and what they're doing for artists here in Charlottesville, which would allow them to be funded, you know, for the work that they do.
And the bridge is, just for those who don't know.
The Bridge is a nonprofit, I believe. I think they're nonprofit. But they are called the Bridge Progressive Arts Initiative, and it's recently been handed over to Matthew Slatz, the new director. So one project that they just did is called Community Supported Arts, which they based off of community supported agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas a farm would provide a box of produce and people would pay the farm, and then when your produce is ready, it's like, come pick up your produce. So they said, why don't we do that for art? And I don't know if they're the first ones to come up with it, but they're the first in Virginia to do it. So they took that model and they, you know, had proposals go out and artists applied, like, what would you do to do something that links people in Charlottesville who may not normally buy art or be interested in art with artists?
Mm-hmm.
So it was out of 40 proposals, four of us were picked.
Mm.
And so then they paid us a stipend to do a project. And we each have to create 50 iterations of something. So I did 50 little lunch pail containers that had a USB drive with a poem on it, and then some little cards that kind of gave the themes of these upcoming performances. And first, I'm actually doing today at 5. So all the people who paid for them, they're going to get to hear me perform for, you know, private performance. And there's one girl, she did an insect book that she made. Another woman makes purses out of old book covers, and she folds them over. Another guy, he creates 3D models on the computer, but then he printed out, and it actually does embroidery. So people got embroidered 3D models.
Oh, wow.
So basically, Matthew, his whole idea was to really, like, how can you get these artists and people who in the community don't really normally engage, like, bring down the barriers.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? So it gives people a way to buy art, and at the same time gives artists a way to make art for them and not have to, like, as we're saying, work the 9-to-5 and then go do something else after the 9-to-5 job.
Well, and I think what's great about that, too, is that it's not just simply, like, I don't think there's an exchange happening there, you know? Like, so it's not just simply, here's some money for your art because, you know, you don't usually make a lot from art. So here's, like, a sympathy money. You know what I'm saying? Not that there's anything wrong with somebody just, you know, being a patron to the arts, which is simply just giving money to the artist to make things. But in this case, there's, like, a real exchange. Like, people are putting in, you know, they're going to put in money to receive something for and receive that person's creation, you know. So I think there's a real sense of mercantile exchange happening, which I think the arts lends itself to. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start there, but you go to creating jobs. Mm-hmm. And then you're really actually, I mean, I think it all points to economic growth, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's really a good thing. It's, you know, you're actually creating goods that can be sold. And I think that's something that can be underestimated.
Mm-hmm. But, all wealth is a result of creativity because all wealth is created. Therefore, without creativity, no wealth is created. What happens is the wealth that already exists is distributed. In a growing world where population is increasing in globalization, if new wealth is not created, then the wealth that already exists from prior creativity will be stretched thin. The standard of living will drop for all, and that can result in civil unrest. So creativity is very, very important. There has never been such a thing as a secure job. There have just been long periods of time in which the jobs that existed were not threatened by outside forces and therefore lasted longer, not because they were innately secure, but because of the nature of the environment that existed at the time. Since that went on for about 100 years, we came up with an idea that there was such thing as a secure job, and there was such thing as being able to have a plan, and there was such a thing as doing 9-to-5 and retiring, and etc. There's nothing wrong with a 9-to-5 format and a retirement format until the society becomes to think that that is secure, that is invincible, and also they start saying that that's real. Because what does one mean when they say real job? They mean secure. Because if I am picking up rocks, it's a job. What does the term real mean in that statement? It's not very clear. But we come to define as real what we are used to. And if we are used to most people doing this format of job, then we come to judge that which is not in line with that format as incorrect. Furthermore, an issue with getting society to understand the value of creativity is that you can't so clearly draw the link between Steve Jobs' calligraphy class and Apple. That relation is not something that I can quote-unquote prove. However, it is most certainly very, very real. Einstein said that the only
reason he came up, well, the main reason he came up with the theory of special relativity that has had long-term ramifications for all technological advancement since is since he read the philosopher David Hume. Many people would think that's a waste of time. Einstein said he would have never come up with what he came up with had he not hung out in his book clubs with his friends and read philosophers. My point is that the arts and humanities are very, very important. I think we only think as a society in terms of creativity as painting. We don't see creativity as the engine that is behind all wealth creation because we don't see how it directly links with wealth creation, but it very much does because the people of who participate in art carry it around within them to all of the actions and activities and organizations and what have you that they participate in. But you have to believe in that. And also I would add that you could say, well, there's, you know, 50 people in the calligraphy class, one Steve Jobs, those 49 other people wasted their time in the calligraphy class. Well, you only need one Steve Jobs to do the calligraphy and create jobs for thousands of people, and it's worth having those other 49 who may not directly use it, although we can't say that for sure because we don't know what they end up doing with the total of their lives. That one person changes the world and thus makes it worth funding and appreciating that calligraphy class or whatever it may be for that one individual who makes the world a better place for all.
You know, I think the not terribly long ago I heard on NPR Science Now, Science Today, whatever the name of the show is, but their point was that many scientists got their ideas from books and lately from movies.
Yes.
There was a couple of scientists on who had seen movies that show all this. Oh, I know. They were speaking specifically about the solar system and there being another one, two, or three of them, and that they started to investigate scientifically this possibility because they'd seen so many sci-fi films. And they thought and said very often this stimulates because when a creator of art starts creating, it's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And then the scientist looks at that imagination and wonders, I wonder if that could be true. And then they start to investigate. And so there's a real practical proof of what we're all saying, especially with what Daniel was saying. Michelle and Bernard, I know you know this too, this new thing you're doing at the Bridge, there's a connection with teaching people how to pitch their art? Is that something separate?
Well, it's not directly related to the Bridge, but something Daniel and I have been working on is called Pitchcraft, which is the idea of how do you integrate a creative mindset with the business mindset. And it's even funny we say that nowadays because they're both, I mean, people, just like you were saying about the scientist, the scientist is praised, something Daniel's, you know, the scientist is praised for his curiosity, but the artist is kind of not, like, oh, you're curious?
Well, go
play, you know. Right. The scientist is doing something real over here. But this idea that everybody is a pitch person. If you get up in front of somebody and you have to captivate them with an idea, what is the difference between a stand-up comedian and a business person who has to do that? Mm. Both people in their own right have to captivate your attention with their idea. Mm. And it's just the way that it's done is, you know, specific to that point of view. But if a comedian doesn't know what he's doing, obviously he's not going to make the audience laugh. Mm. And if a business person doesn't know what he's doing, obviously he's not going to get his idea across. So why can't both sides learn from one another?
Yeah.
Especially because everybody is human, so everybody wants to laugh. Everybody uses words, so why not bring in a poet? You know, everybody, to some degree, likes watching films or storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So why can't all of these, you know, attributes that come with the package of being comedian, poet, actress, work for a business person? Because otherwise you're only speaking to, like, a particular part of somebody's brain. Here's my product, buy it. But you have to really you know, the best commercials make you laugh and make you think a little bit and, you know, make you chuckle and walk away. It's like, maybe I don't want to buy that product, but I remember it. You know, if nothing else, you would remember it.
You know, this reminds me that when I taught acting for TV commercials in New York for many years, of course, first of all, there were actors who came, but as the word got around with how I was teaching it, all of a sudden my classes were half full with attorneys and with other disciplines. What were they? Oh, retired people looking for a second career. But I like that attorneys and others were coming, and I know there was another discipline, I can't remember, that were coming to study on-camera technique for making presentations. Oh, it was businessmen. That's what it was. It was corporate people and attorneys. Mm. But Michelle.
Oh, well, I was thinking about how, you know, a lot of businessmen actually do have their own sort of art form when it comes to negotiation, and they have their own ways of talking with their clients, and they're often very well, you know, very good at what they do because they make sales and they do what they need to do for their company. I think that to the point, I mean, Bernard touched on it, Daniel said it before, but like the idea though that if you do the same thing for when it comes to like pitching an idea, like simply for the sake of like learning. I mean, we get it now with like TED, you know, we get like the TED Talks. We love how people present their ideas and it's become a very popular thing. But it's a kind of a question of like, it's something I've been thinking about a lot lately is how ideas are both the most valuable things and also they cost nothing. Like you could just overhear somebody say something brilliant that changes your life.
Yes.
That's invaluable. Yes. And yet, at the same time, they didn't make any money from that, from that ability to share it. I mean, I think that points to the fact that money isn't everything. You know, it's kind of is what allows us to solve problems, and it is part of the economy, and it's not a bad thing, but it's certainly not everything. Mm. You know, but I think that with this whole idea of pitchcraft. So there's the businessman. He does his pitches his own way. There's the comedian. You know, the artist, the poet. But I think what's great about pitchcraft and what I've heard about it, I haven't had the privilege of seeing it yet, but is that it takes the idea of how would a comedian portray his message. You know, like he also has some truth he has to say for the joke to make sense,
sure.
You know. And how does the, you know, how would a poet convey their message? And I think all of that can really help one understand how it is a performance, in a sense, to really allow people to understand where you're coming from and really get it.
Mm-hmm.
So pitchcraft is great to do that. It really kind of clearly shows a cross-disciplinary form of communication, really. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And we'll be getting those videos up hopefully soon on cyperideas.com, cyperideas.com.
I was going to say, let us know where we can find this.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me there's a basic thing, too, that we're saying, and while it may seem to be an insurmountable mountain, we should say it because saying it is the first step to climbing and surmounting it, and that is all of us here today are saying the public at large needs to change or evolve their opinion of what is a real job and their opinion of the artists in that world, because all artists are entrepreneurs and all entrepreneurs are artists in one form or another. It's a creative process, and there is tremendous artistic creation that influences what we call the real job. The real job. Artists are part of the... artists are real.
Can I throw this in right quick? Well, it's funny that, you know, related to what Michelle is saying about art being portrayed as the extra, like, oh, well, that's nice, like, on the weekend, when you want to do that. But why is it that every year at UVA, when they have the valedictory speeches,
yes,
and then they have the commencement address at the actual graduation ceremony, the valedictory speeches are the most liked because they have a celebrity or an athlete.
Yes,
last spring or fall, Stephen Colbert was there.
Yes, yes.
People came out in the rain rain site to see him,
right.
And as soon as he was done talking, everybody was leaving. Right. You know, the kid got up and was like, "Oh, I'm the class president." Everybody was like, "Okay, it's funny how people present this idea that this is more important than this, but then the actual tangible evidence shows what people adhere to.
Well, it's happiness, you know. I mean, I've sat around at wonderful times in my life. I have to and looked at all the things I had acquired, and my response to all of it was,
Yeah, but they're just things. Mm. To have someone at your side at the beginning and end of every day, or on a drive on the back roads, that's happiness. A poem that moves you, that's happiness. It's spiritual, and it's the artist who gives us that. It's any creative person, you know. Again, as I think Daniel said, it's not just a paintbrush in your hand. Art is ideas and imagination and creativity that leads to any number of things.
Well, what you just need is a return to the Renaissance man. I mean, Leibniz was doing tests on air pressure as he was turning around and writing the philosophy that he was doing. It's been about, I guess, 180 years that we've had this movement towards specialization and the idea that a person does one task. What we're actually calling for is simply a return to an older way of life, in a way which genius is understood as holistic rather than specialized knowledge. I don't think it's by chance that as we've come to create, in a way, an idol of security, that you have a focus on this kind of specialization. I think also one of the reasons everyone knows that they're supposed to say that money isn't everything, but we act as a society as if money is everything because we're afraid. So we're afraid of, well, what happens if Jimmy, you know, goes out and does painting, or what happens if Steve Jobs takes calligraphy? He could be getting extra credits, and then he's going to waste his potential and never be anyone who ever makes a difference. And what if he goes to India and goes on this bicycle? Oh my goodness, he's going to waste his life. You know, it's that idea of fear. John 4:18, I think, it says, the one who fears is not made perfect in love, because fear has to do with torment. So what we need is a more fearless society, and as a society becomes more fearless, it will return to a state of the quote-unquote Renaissance man, and also will be made perfect in love.
Or even feel the fear and do it anyway, which is, you know, the famous book. It's not that life isn't full of challenge and fears, but the point is either you roll over and stay in bed, or you get up and you do the best you can do.
Well, to add, there's a difference between the fear of I see a lion, therefore I'm going to run from it, which is just smart. It would be stupid not to run from the lion. And the fear of if I don't do this thing, then tomorrow something bad's going to happen. That kind of fear, the second, is a sort of faith. You believe in this dreaded thing. That's the sort of fear that we need to do away with, and then direct the other kinds of fears toward our destiny.
Another thing is, you know, speaking of art, I like to take that A and turn it to appreciation. And I think, you know, a lot of class, you know, school used to at least have an art appreciation
class.
That's right,
I remember that.
Hey, you may not be an artist, but you should learn the process.
And
I think that has to do a lot with what we're saying, because I think it's hilarious when people say, well, you can't become an artist because that doesn't make money. Not realizing that very attitude is why it does not make money. Like, if you yourself and other people would start to appreciate what art was, then you would actually go see it and pay for it, and money would be made. But people just say, oh, it doesn't make money. Yes, because you're not giving money to it. So there's the problem. You are part of the problem.
And to that, as much as, you know, with the talk of minimum wage, people don't have no problem with having some artist get up during an open mic and not make a dime, and we don't look at that as sort of a violation of human labor, which says a lot about what we value as a culture.
I was also thinking about art and, you know, the fact that it makes life beautiful, and it reminds me a lot of, like, cooking. And I don't know, I always think about things like the domestic work of life, because it's something that I care to do, and you know, making a space beautiful, like painting a room, or you know, picking certain colors or fonts, you know, that cooking a good meal versus just like a 5-minute meal. You know, I think that all of those things have a lot of beauty, and they're such a, you know, a daily part of our experiences that, you know, it really does make a big difference, you know, when you are in a space and it feels like a home, you know what I mean, versus feeling just like a room. But I think, you know, that small example that maybe seems unimportant to me is a very important, you know, picture of something much bigger, which is the fact that somebody taking the time to do that, it means that they care, you know, and they care to make a place that a person wants to be in. And I think larger in life, lately I've been contemplating the evils of the world and just despairing, but I think something that makes me hopeful is that we all can make a difference. You know, when you make something beautiful, that's like choosing to be nice to my friend Bernard, you know, instead of being insulting to him, you know. So that seems like, well, how does that have to do with aesthetics and art? It's because it's creative, you know. It takes creativity to overcome sometimes your feelings, or overcome nothing, just mm-hmm. doing nothing and doing something positive, you know, or instead of taking creation and going in a destructive direction, taking creativity and going in a positive direction, mm-hmm. and realizing that that has much more value, you know, than almost anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've covered a lot and a lot to think about, and it still comes down to us. But respect the artist and respect the artist in you, because we are all creating something every moment with every thought and every feeling and every reaction. This has been The Reasonable Voice. In the studio today with me have been the technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Daniel Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose and recently engaged to be married. Thank you for joining us today and every day and recommending us to your friends. I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping that you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.